The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots to get to on today's program. So much going on in the news. Also, many of you know our Glasgow pack is scheduled for this weekend. Tomorrow night, in fact, up in Glasgow, the crew is off and running early this morning, taking all the equipment and the literature up there. So they'll be there later this afternoon. And then I'll be heading up with Brad McDonald and his wife soon after that. So we've got a lot to report on early next week as far as the work is concerned, following the PAC Saturday night, and then again on Sunday afternoon, and we'll be here to give you an update on that for Monday's program, and hopefully together with that update, we'll have some sound from the people attending the PAC, like we've done with the London PAC and also Belfast. So you can look forward to that for Monday's program. Well, what a big news day this is. You've got the mass shooting in New Zealand. We're working on a Trumpet article for that early this morning. I think that's posted at the website now. But we can start, I think, with the police commissioner, Mike Bush, from New Zealand, confirming that 49 people were killed in this this shooting down in Christchurch. This is clip three.
At the Dean's Avenue Mosque, we now know that 41 people have lost their lives. And at the Linwood Mosque, 7 have lost their lives. Of the 40 people who have been treated at Christchurch Hospital, 1 has now passed. So the total number of people who have died in this horrendous event are 49.
Fox News says that the perpetrator, and at least there's one that's been apprehended thus far. I think a few other arrests have been made, although they don't know for sure if they're connected to this killer, a 28-year-old Australian-born citizen. He's the one now in custody and has admitted to the attack, so far as we know right now. This this disturbing clip here coming from one of the witnesses who described the scene when he entered into the mosque. Clip one.
I pushed myself to get inside the mosque, and it was unbelievable. I saw in the main room on the right-hand side about 20-plus people. Some of them were dead. Some of them were screaming. On the left-hand side, I saw about 10-plus people. Some of them were dead, and some of them were screaming, and they were asking me, is there any ambulance on the way? I said, you know, be patient. And I saw on the floor the bullet shells, so many, hundreds of.
That's coming from one of the witnesses that saw the scene there after the attack. The New Zealand Prime Minister, she talked about this being a very dark day for New Zealand. Clip two.
I'm not currently in a position to confirm the number of deaths or injuries, but I have to acknowledge people can see images live from Christchurch. It will be obvious to them that this is a significant event. And I can tell you now, this is and will be one of New Zealand's darkest days.
One of New Zealand's darkest days. And we're just seeing this more and more worldwide. Just a couple of days ago, there was the school shooting in Brazil. And we know there's quite a few problems elsewhere in South America as well. But you just hopscotch around the globe. 8 people killed in the school in Brazil. Now 49 at these two mosques. There's a spirit behind all of this. You hop over to Israel. Last night, Israel sent, I think, 100 rockets into Gaza in response to rockets that were aimed at Tel Aviv. So here's Israel's response, and Egyptian mediators have stepped in to try to negotiate a ceasefire. They're trying to determine whether or not the firings coming out of Gaza, whether or not that was an accident. In any event, Israel struck back quickly. Haaretz says, while the army already suspected as much while the attack was still ongoing, it holds Hamas accountable for any type of violence coming from the Strip and acted accordingly. It says the last time rocket alerts were activated in Tel Aviv was 2 years ago in what turned out to be a false alarm. The flare-up comes 3 weeks before Israel holds its general election on April 9th. And we could add to that that this comes after this Temple Mount flare-up as well. Brent Nachtigall put together a video just a few days ago on how that what's happening at the Temple Mount. It's threatening to ignite a lot more violence all across the West Bank and Gaza. And then you look at the turmoil that Britain is in right now. Yesterday, Richard Palmer filled in on the program. You can see or hear his program. Brexit throws Britain into historic chaos. It's a chaotic scene in the House of Commons. Day in and day out, like I was saying on Wednesday, you just don't know what to expect now. You don't know where this is headed. You don't know what the solution is. The Associated Press reported today, in a stalemate over Brexit, British politicians have chosen to delay it. So we don't know what to do, so let's just try to kick the can down the road a little bit. The AP says after weeks of political gridlock, Parliament voted Thursday to seek to postpone the country's departure from the European Union, a move that will likely avert a chaotic withdrawal on the scheduled exit date of March 29th. And so they kick the can down the road, and really they do it against the will of the people, as Melanie Phillips wrote today as well. She said on Wednesday evening, amid uproar in the House of Commons, MPs voted not to leave with no deal under any circumstances. Yet last year, they passed an Act of Parliament committing the UK to leave the EU on March 29, whether or not withdrawal terms had been agreed. So, here's how she sums it up. They have now voted against themselves, the law they passed, and the British people. Melanie Phillips says the fundamental reason for the impasse is that most MPs want to remain in the EU. That's the truth. The reason why we're at this impasse is because the leadership wants to stay in the EU. The people want to leave. But the members of Parliament, they want to stay. She says they are therefore at odds with the electorate, whose fury over this perceived coup against the people is hard to exaggerate. Listen to the reaction of the British public. This is from Question Time just last night, clip 4.
We had a referendum, right? That wasn't meaningless, or was it? Because if we have a third referendum or a second referendum, where does it end? Why don't we just honour what the people voted for, and then take a view as to whether or not that was right or wrong? The people voted for a reason. They got out of their beds, they went down to the polling station and they voted. It is nothing but sheer arrogance. Arrogance of people that have lost and people that want to subvert democracy. That we are now asking for a third referendum.
Well,
get on what the people voted for.
I didn't look into the guest for that particular show. She usually has, BBC usually has 5 or 6 people up there, but Parliament no doubt was represented. But what you heard there, that was the reaction from the audience. Why won't you move on with what we voted for? This is arrogance. Arrogance, the audience member said. This is Parliament subverting democracy. There was a headline at the Telegraph this morning that said, the Brexit betrayal is turning mild-mannered people into unexpected revolutionaries. You heard some of that just last night. When will it boil over? Mild-mannered people, they're upset. They're furious. It's hard to exaggerate, as Melanie Phillips said. Why so much division and discontent all over the world? Like I say, this is one of many hotspots. You just take a quick tour through the world and there's problems. And those problems are intensifying and multiplying. And there's so little in the way of solutions. That AP report said the Brexit, with Brexit due in 15 days and no divorce deal yet approved, the House voted to ask the bloc to put off Britain's exit until at least June 30th. So it gives the Prime Minister a little breathing space, the article says. But still, here she is, Theresa May. She's been promising for 2 years that we're leaving on March 29, no matter what deal or no deal or anything in between. We're leaving on March 29. That's what the people wanted. And so now she's breathing easier because it's postponed. But listen to this from the AP. It says power to approve or reject the extension lies with the EU of all things, which has signaled that it will only allow a delay if Britain either approves a divorce deal or makes a fundamental shift in its approach to Brexit. The Associated Press says, in a historic irony, almost 3 years after Britain voted to leave the EU, its future is now in the bloc's hands. Britain votes to leave the EU, and now the future for Britain in the EU. Well, the EU determines that, at least the way that it is right now. What a mess. Just like Mr. Armstrong said it would be in 1973. You're going to regret the day that you joined. Now they're trying to get out, and they can't even do it. Well, I got into that some on Wednesday, and I know Richard did again yesterday. But it's such a big story here. On this side of the Atlantic, Fraser Nelson at the Telegraph, he said a no-deal Brexit could have worked. A radical stimulus, low tariffs, low taxes, immediate assurance granted to all EU nationals, accepting more high-skilled migrants, all kinds of options could have been open, but this would require not just a Tory majority, but a decent leader. Wow. That's some hard-hitting rebuke for the leadership in Britain, for the leadership at 10 Downing Street. This would require not just a Tory majority, but a decent leader able to unite and inspire the country. The odds on one emerging anytime soon are, to put it mildly, slim. And so you think of other prophecies being fulfilled, besides ones in Hosea, as we discussed on Wednesday, but Isaiah 3 as well, the dearth of leadership, the lack of leaders in Israel today, Ephraim, Manasseh, Judah, or Great Britain, the United States, and the Israeli state. There were options if there were stronger leaders. President Trump, he had some remarks yesterday in response to the Brexit fiasco, and there were quite a few commentators on this side of the Atlantic that would rather him stay out of it, or that saw his comments as an attack on Britain. Here's what he had to say yesterday, clip 5.
I'm surprised at how badly it's all gone from the standpoint of a negotiation. But I gave the Prime Minister my ideas on how to negotiate it, and I think you would have been successful. She didn't listen to that, and that's fine. I mean, she's got to do what she's got to do, but I think it could have been negotiated in a different manner, frankly. I hate to see everything being ripped apart right now. I don't think another vote would be possible because it would be very unfair to the people that won. They'd say, what do you mean you're going to take another vote? So that'll be tough. But I thought it would happen. It did happen. And both sides are very, very, they're cemented in. It's a tough situation. It's a shame. Frankly, it's a shame.
That's President Trump yesterday responding to the ongoing Brexit turmoil. The independent newspaper called those remarks an extraordinary attack They see President Trump's statements as an extraordinary attack on Britain. The Spectator's response to that is that, well, what's so extraordinary about it, these comments? In fact, what he said is true. The Spectator writes, Donald Trump has, for the last 2 years, been remarkably consistent on Brexit. Throughout the process, he has done nothing but offer the British government friendship and a trade deal. He made the same offer this morning. The British government has not responded in kind. It says here, Trump told May that she should sue the EU. They scoff. How ridiculous. Well, how's the Prime Minister's preferred approach working out? It's easy to scoff at Donald Trump. It's easy to pile on him when everyone in the Western media hates him. They despise him. So anything he says, if he came out on the opposite side for Brexit, they'd tell him to keep quiet. They'd view it as an extraordinary attack. Spectator says, for various reasons, the British government has never been able to compute the idea that no matter how much people may dislike the 45th president, he is our friend on Brexit. He's our friend. It could have been useful for Britain to have had a bilateral relationship with his administration, especially in the context of our departure from the EU. It says, finally, it should have been possible to take advantage of the fact that, for various psychological reasons, Trump sees himself as son to Brexit Moon, but it wasn't. That's a serious diplomatic failure. It shows how unimaginative and weak-minded Britain's political leadership is. Well, for all of his faults, Donald Trump certainly has an imagination, and he's willing to shake up the status quo. If you look at that prophecy in Hosea 5 about Ephraim walking after the commandment of Jeroboam, that may be some indication that however this plays out, as my father has said before, you're going to see the United States and Britain probably draw closer together in the short term. Even though they're not exactly there right now. But however this plays out, it's fascinating to watch. I know so many prophecies are at play here. I guess when you look at everything that's been happening in the past 24 hours, I don't know. I'm not there. I'm not watching CNN or Fox News. But one would hope that at least there have been some international events that have captured some headlines in the United States. And you look at the last 24 hours, too, even within the U.S., quite a lot that's going on there as well. The vote yesterday in the Senate, voting against that emergency action that the president wants to take to start building the wall. It's legislation that was put in place in 1976, and every president since has used it. Now Donald Trump uses it, and suddenly it's unconstitutional. Where were these senators who are now trying to stop the funding for the wall, who are now trying to stop the president in dealing with this emergency? And who can deny that it's an emergency with people streaming across the border? No border security. Not much to speak of anyway. And now, not during 8 years of Obama, but now these senators want to take a stand because the president wants to follow through on a law that they established in 1976. Congress did. So there's fighting that continues over the wall. And then you have the never-ending investigations. Perhaps the Mueller probe is nearing its end. Yesterday, the so-called Mueller bulldog, pit bull, I guess is what they say, he decided to step down, Andrew Weissman, NPR, reported on it this way. It said one of the most prominent members of special counsel Robert Mueller's team investigating Russia's attack in the 2016 presidential election will soon leave the office and the Justice Department. This is according to two sources. Weissmann's going to step down. He's going to move on. And listen to this paragraph. It's hard to even take it seriously, but somebody, I guess, wrote it with a straight face. It says, Andrew Weissmann, the architect of the case against former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort, will study and teach at the New York University and work on a variety of public service projects, including his longstanding interest in preventing wrongful convictions. He's had a longstanding interest in preventing wrongful convictions. This is the man who destroyed the one-man wrecking crew, who destroyed Arthur Andersen, the accounting firm, back in 2002. He took the entire company down for its connections to Enron. The Enron collapse in the early 2000s took down an entire accounting firm. And then now he's been going on for 2 years. Chasing after anyone and everyone associated with Donald Trump, not just Paul Manafort, anyone. And then NPR, I guess, just in passing, oh yeah, he's had a long-standing interest in preventing wrongful convictions. The hubris of these people, whether in the media or in the deep state, the arrogance. Here they've been for the past 2 years. They've been throwing the kitchen sink and everything else at people only because of their political affiliation. And more evidence continues to come forward of this shameful behavior. Giving their friends on the Democrat side a free pass, a get-out-of-jail-free card. But really tightening the screws on everyone associated with Donald Trump. No wonder there's so many senators that are so quick to abandon ship and join with Nancy Pelosi, because when they do that, they're treated like celebrities. You could feel it in the reporting last night. All these senators that are joining Nancy Pelosi, this is great. What a setback for the president. Didn't seem to faze Mr. Trump much. He said, well, we're going to veto it and move forward. And there's quite a few commentators that say the law's probably on his side. You never know these days with the kinds of judges that we see weighing in. But stepping back, look at all the division. Andy McCarthy, speaking of Paul Manafort, he talked about, of course, there were the two sentences handed down, one last week and then another one this week, and they amount to something like 7 years in jail or in prison. And the Democrats, of course, they want to see him in there for life. They want to see him rot away in prison. I went through that with you last week. So here are these two sentences, and then you received news the other day of another indictment. So some prosecutor somewhere in New York, they're not finished. Andy McCarthy says here, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office has indicted Paul Manafort for mortgage fraud and more than a dozen other state felonies. It says, this is a nakedly political prosecution. And then I won't take time to get too far into the weeds on this. He talks about the double jeopardy laws and what happens if there's a federal prosecution as opposed to a state prosecution. But let me just carry on toward the end of his piece. He says the federal charges had nothing to do with the rationale for the special counsel's investigation, which involves Russia's interference in the 2016 election. He's talking about the charges from the past 2 years that are now all the way through court, and then the sentences have been handed out and so on. But now these more recent charges, the ones that came down just over the past week, he says the New York State charges announced shortly after Manafort's second federal sentencing raised some interesting legal and strategic questions about double jeopardy and pardons. So why would they come forward now with more indictments, with more charges, and the crimes, they're very similar to what he's already had to go through, this man? It says, and now gamesmanship is the order of the day. This is Andy McCarthy writing. He says, the state prosecutors have brought a case they otherwise never would waste time on, not because the case should be done, but to try to block a pardon. In other words, the prosecutors in New York, the prosecutors in Manhattan, they are anticipating that the president will pardon Paul Manafort, which would effectively wipe out the record. He'd have a clean slate, which means that with these new indictments, they could go after him again. They're anticipating a pardon. This is the whole motivation behind it. Because he's affiliated with Donald Trump, or he was. And we're not going to let Donald Trump get the victory in the end. McCarthy says this raw politicization of prosecutorial power ought to frighten everyone. Yet solely because of Donald Trump and Paul Manafort, New York Democrats have been pushing to water down the state double jeopardy protection, shamefully, as if civil rights were only for the ruling class's political friends. Well, he goes on to give his recommendation of what the president ought to do. He concludes with this. I don't carry any brief for Manafort. Indeed, I have argued that he got a much lighter sentence than federal guidelines for his crimes called for because Mueller manipulated federal conspiracy statutes to cap his sentence at 10 years. No one, however, no one should be singled out for prosecution because of his political associations. McCarthy says, look, I'm not trying to defend everything that Manafort has done. Far from it. He's gotten involved in some shady activity. But the bigger crime here is that he's been singled out for prosecution because of political associations. That's obvious for anyone with eyes to see. He says, finally, the New York District Attorney did not indict Manafort because he committed mortgage fraud. The DA indicted Manafort because he worked on the Trump campaign and could be pardoned during Trump's presidency. That is disgraceful. That is disgraceful. More indictments just this past week. Because, well, we've got to now anticipate the possibility of a pardon and make sure that this former Trump campaign advisor goes to jail for a long, long time. Let me just return, before we conclude this segment, let me just return to Melanie Phillips. She was writing on Brexit. I gave you a short quote earlier. But in the end of her piece, she talks about the problem with our nations in general. She writes, the mass hysteria over Brexit and U.S. President Donald Trump, the loss of reason under the onslaught of anti-West ideology, and the eruption of anti-Semitism are all symptoms of a civilizational sickness, she says. Here is a sickness. And what does it say in Isaiah 1? God says to his people Israel, they don't know me. They won't return to me. There's a sickness that's there, head to toe, through and through. And it's being exposed, isn't it? Every day. Here in Ephraim, in the United States, in Judah, all over the world, in fact. Phillips says radical Islam, which understood more clearly than the West itself, the evisceration of Western culture, duly seized its opportunity. And having been all but invited by Europe and President Barack Obama's America to dig itself in, is now adding immeasurably to the confusion. You've got the civilizational sickness in the nations of Israel, and you've got radical Islam adding immeasurably to the confusion. Phillips says, maybe we're now even seeing the world begin to pivot on its political axis. While the West and the Islamic world are locked together in a desperate struggle like two dying dinosaurs still fighting for territory, The developing world is becoming less poor and better educated and is slowly beginning to liberate its women. She feels like the balance is tilting in the other direction. Well, we know that the problems overall, they span the globe. They're worldwide, first world and third world and everywhere in between. But she brings up a powerful point right at the end. Again, talking about the dearth of leadership in our nations today and the lack of miracles. She writes, without Winston Churchill's leadership in the Second World War, Britain would have fallen to the Nazis. But now Britain has no leadership to give its MPs the courage they need to march away from the pharaohs of Brussels. She says it may take a modern miracle to save Brexit now, and with it, the last slim chance of British participation in the battle to save the West. That's from Melanie Phillips. She's recently told us, by the way, that she hopes to be in the United States maybe later this year. So if all goes well, perhaps she'll have an opportunity to stop by Edmond, Oklahoma again and to speak at the Armstrong Auditorium. We'll see. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. To those who followed the broadcasts and writings of Herbert W. Armstrong throughout his long ministry, and who still remember, world events today are an electrifying endorsement of the power of biblical revelation. Much of Mr. Armstrong's forecasting was proven accurate within his own lifetime, but since his death in 1986, events are proving him right all the more. For a comprehensive review of Mr. Armstrong's analysis, request our free booklet, He Was Right. He Was Right summarizes many of the Bible-based prophecies Mr. Armstrong proclaimed for more than 50 years. This booklet takes you back to the spiritual roots of the Philadelphia Church of God and the Trumpet magazine. To assemble the material in this booklet, our staff looked back through decades of old plain truth issues, looking for Mr. Armstrong's bold predictions. We then matched those prophetic statements with what actually happened or is now happening on the world scene. The result was amazing. The sheer number of prophetic statements made by Mr. Armstrong and his editorial team and their accuracy will astound you. The world may scoff, but Herbert Armstrong was right. Just how right is daily becoming apparent as we teeter on the brink of catastrophic global events that will lead to the greatest geopolitical intervention of all time, the return of Jesus Christ to this war-torn, war-weary earth. To order our free booklet, email your request to td@kpcg.fm. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
On last week's program, the last show of the week, Friday, we went through a study on Colossians chapter 3. And I just want to start with the first couple of verses there. Because it'll lead into some other verses that I want to draw your attention to. You look at all of the darkness in the world today, the evil, like what just happened in New Zealand today, a nation that's now mourning the loss, 49 people killed. This is a dark hour for New Zealand, so says its prime minister. And as in other verses, Colossians 3 here says that we need to lift up our eyes, our thoughts, our minds, to the things above, where you don't see this kind of evil, this kind of slaughter, this kind of division and discontent. If your hearts are on the things which are above, you're going to be filled with God's nature, with godly joy and love. Seek those things which are above, it says in Colossians 3:1. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, Jesus said. He said that in the Gospels. Go after it. You really have to work hard to look up, to seek those things that are above, to set our minds on the things above, not on earthly things. You focus in on the things of this earth, and it's very easy to get discouraged and to be negative and to be cynical. Look at those people in Question Time last night, their reaction to their government. It's, as Melanie Phillips said, it's hard to exaggerate the fury, the disgust. John 4, the Gospel of John, this is Jesus Christ together with his disciples. Picking it up in verse 31, it says, in the meanwhile, his disciples prayed him, saying, Master, eat. They were trying to get Jesus Christ to eat some food. He needed physical sustenance. And Christ's response, verse 32, it says, I have meat to eat that you know not of. Now, the disciples didn't yet have God's Holy Spirit. And so this statement kind of confused them. They were thinking just in terms of the physical. Well, surely he needs food. He needs to eat. But he was teaching them a valuable lesson here, a deep spiritual lesson. Verse 34, Jesus said unto them, my meat is to do the will of him that sent me and to finish his work. This was his food, God's work. This was the food that fueled Jesus Christ. This was the real sustenance and strength that moved him, that motivated him, that inspired him every day. This was his purpose for being. He did eat. He was a flesh and blood human being like you and me. But his passion, even above physical food, was to serve in the work of God. His passion was to finish the work of God. My father wrote in John's Gospel, The Love of God, he said, this is the key to having passion and high spirits. The work of God has a built-in vision of joy. It always keeps us looking beyond the difficulties of the present and seeing where this is all leading. You have to look beyond the difficulties of the present in Christchurch, in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, in London, in America, in Brazil, in Venezuela. You have to look beyond the difficulties of the present and see where this is all leading. God's work has a built-in, joyous vision. And if our passion is to finish the work, if it's to consume this kind of meat, the kind that Jesus is talking about here, then our lives are going to be overflowing with a superabundance of joy and love. Think of Mr. Armstrong, even as he was commenting on so many of the tragedies of his day. Think about how excited he was so often when talking about anything and everything that had to do with furthering the work. Every time he talked about it, he always conveyed, well, just such a tremendous excitement and energy. It's because his heart was in the work. Jesus Christ, his heart was in the work. My father went on to say, Christ wasn't even thinking about physical food. His mind was on why he, the Word, was made flesh. If you get your heart into God's work and give it everything you have, it will give you all the exuberance and the joy God has to give us on earth. Just put your heart into it and then reap the blessings that will come from that. We're going through Philippians and epistles right now, this remarkable congregation that from the very beginning, they just poured their hearts into the work. And Paul thanked them right at the start of the book. He thanked them for their generosity. And more than that, he thanked them for their consistency. They were constant. They didn't waver. He really did praise them for their strengths in 2 Corinthians 8, 2 Corinthians 9, 2 Corinthians 11 or 12, I think it is. He just kept talking about those generous people from Macedonia. He was trying to inspire the Corinthian brethren. Look at the people in Macedonia. Look at the churches like Philippi. And follow in those steps. Follow their example. Look at how much they're being blessed. It's as simple as Acts 20 and verse 35. It's more blessed to give than to receive. That's what we want for our members to really be grounded in. That's what we want for our coworkers, our donors, our trumpet readers. Continuing on in this passage, verse 35, it says, Say not you, there are yet 4 months, and then comes harvest. Behold, I say unto you, lift up your eyes and look on the fields, for they are white already to harvest. Lift up your eyes. Look ahead. Look forward. The fields are ready. There's a huge harvest out there. They're just waiting to be gathered. That should give us quite a lot of hope and inspiration when doing God's work. Of course, we're a small group. Of course, it's a scattered bunch, scattered over all the earth. But you have these events like the Glasgow Pack. You have the Portland Pack coming up next weekend. And the growth that will come from that. Christ is saying, look, don't think that there's no growth coming. Don't get discouraged. Don't get discouraged because tens of thousands don't lend their support, because they don't just turn out from the woodwork and all of a sudden you've got this great throng of people. Just get out there and start harvesting. God's given us the means to really get a message out using radio and TV and the internet. And we're not that far away from when the spotlight is going to be turned on to this church, this organization, the work, the message, the teachings of God's church. We've got to see what's coming. We've got to project ahead. We've got to look out. We've got to set our minds on the things above, lift our eyes. My father had a personal a few years ago, lift up your eyes. And he quoted the famous statement from Neil Armstrong, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. We're in the 50-year anniversary of that moonwalk. We'll have more to talk about that as the year unfolds. 1969, the moonwalk that galvanized the world even, not just the United States, the whole world, stirred, inspired. It stirred the imagination back in 1969, looking up into the heavens, lifting up our eyes, and considering the moon and the planets and the stars. Isaiah 40 in verse 26, it says similarly, lift up your eyes on high, and behold who has created these things. These things that brings out their host by number, it says. He calls them all by names. By the greatness of his might, for that he is strong in power, not one fails. This is speaking of the great omnipotent God who created the universe, who sustains the vast universe. All of the precision, everything in order, functioning like the great master clock, as Mr. Armstrong would say. The infinite number of stars and planets, he knows all of them by name. And here we are. We so often just want to stare down. We want to turn down our eyes, not lift them up. We want to look down into the soil. Not that there's anything wrong with examining the creation around us here on earth. Romans 1 says it proves God's existence. But when you think of science today and the never-ending attempt, the religion really, to connect human beings to animals, when God says we ought to be looking in the other direction and considering the link between God and human beings. Genesis 1:26, let us make man in our image. That's God talking. David, when he meditated in Psalm 8, he said in verse 3, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? For you have made him a little lower than the angels, or for a little while lower than the angels, and have crowned him with glory and honor. You made him to have dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet. And you can see where the Apostle Paul expounded upon this psalm, Psalm 8, over in Hebrews 2. He expanded on it even. God kept expanding the vision. He kept expanding this truth, adding to the revelation, adding to the knowledge. And that's the way that he wants us to be. If we're really delving into our Bible study and then lifting up our eyes on high, setting our minds on the things above, staying always hopeful, always positive, filled with joy. We have to in this dark, dark world. And look, it's getting darker. Sobering events every single day. We have to watch them. We have to watch and pray, and it is sobering. But it also is motivating. It also makes us cry out in our prayers for God's kingdom to come. Thy kingdom come, right there at the outset of the prayer outline. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. God's glorious kingdom. Hebrews 2 here. This is the passage. The passage that relates directly to Psalm 8. Paul in verse 5, he says, for unto the angels has he not put in subjection the world to come whereof we speak. This is the context of this passage. This inspired passage. The context is the world to come. It's not going to be put under the subjection to the angels, the fallen angels, the demons, Satan's demon administration, Satan's army. Who will have jurisdiction over the universe? Who will have positions of rule in this world to come? Well, Paul quotes David. In the Psalms, he says, but one in a certain place testified, saying, what is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you visit him? For you made him for a little while lower than the angels. You crowned him with glory and honor, and did set over him the works of your hands. Paul quotes from Psalm 8, asking why. Why should God be so interested in human beings? Why should he be so aware of what it is that you and me, what we're doing, what we're thinking about, what we're setting our minds on, what we're looking at. Lift up your eyes. Verse 8, it says, you have put all things in subjection under his feet. For in that he put all in subjection under him, he left nothing, nothing that is not put under him. But now we see not yet all things put under him. We see that we haven't yet received this power and authority, this responsibility. But that's coming soon. That comes at the return of Christ. The context, as verse 5 brings out, is the world to come. We know about the world today. We saw more on that in the first segment. But what about the world to come? Can your mind grasp this mind-boggling truth? Can you receive the truth of God and believe it? The Weymouth translation of verse 8, it says, God has put everything in subjection under mankind's feet. For this subjecting of the universe to man implies the leaving nothing. The leaving nothing not subject to him. It's all going to be subject to the authority and the rule of the saints. God created men. We started off as physical beings. We're on a lower plane than the angels for a little while. For a little while, but looking at it long term, if we lift up our eyes and look into the heavens, then we can learn a little bit more about our eternal purpose, and that it's to be born into God's family and to become more powerful even than the angels above, destined one day to rule the universe. It's a breathtaking future, and it's reserved for the sons of God, the family of God. We're not yet born into that family. But as Paul explains in the very next sentence, but we do not as yet, that is, in our present physical mortal state, we do not as yet see the universe subject to men. It hasn't happened yet, but it is coming. Lift up your eyes. Set your mind on these things, especially as we see this world turn to ever greater forms of evil and violence and hatred. We need this. We need it every day. We need it to lift our spirits. It's like my father said in that quote I gave to you earlier. This is from John's Gospel, the love of God. He said, this is the key to having passion and high spirits. He said, the work of God has a built-in vision of joy. It always keeps us looking beyond the difficulties of the present and seeing where all of this is leading. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're putting the finishing touches on yet another week of broadcasting here on KPCG and KPCG.fm. Email us this weekend, td@kpcg.fm. We'll see you next week.